Hi, everybody. Welcome to the second call in our teleseries for the Awakened World 2012 conference in Rome and in Florence. We're watching people on our screen still signing on to the call, so we want to get started for those of you who have been waiting. My name is Barbara Fields, and I'd like to say hello to my conference co-director, Jim Kenny. Hello, Jim.
Hi. Hi, Barbara.
And
my microphone just went on. Hi.
Oh, good. And I'm representing the Association for Global New Thought, one of the co-conveners for this grand event. And Jim is representing, do you want to name your organizations, Jim?
Yeah, I think my microphone is off again.
But I can hear you.
Okay, good. I'm with the International Interreligious Peace Council and also the Interreligious Engagement Project.
Great, and I want to say hello to our assistants, Megan Stanek and Donna Burns. We have a couple of core group contributors that are going to be with us on the call today, along with all of you. I'd like to say hi to Harold Kazimoff, who's calling in from
Grinnell, Iowa.
Grinnell, of course, my favorite school on the planet. And Gordon Varen, you want to tell us what's going on over there, Gordon?
Yes, hello, Barbara. Yes, and I'm here with my wife, Joan Borisenko, who is also a member of the core group. We're on our deck in in Colorado, watching a wildfire that's sprung up this afternoon. It's still about 10 miles from us, but right on the edge of Boulder, Colorado, but with big winds and erratic winds. So we'll stay with you for as long as we can, but we may have to jump.
Wow, this is dedication. One of the things that I don't always, that's a little frustrating about the teleconferences, even though I appreciate having these technologies, is that it still feels a little bit like we're all sitting alone or in ones or twos in our offices. So I wonder, Megan, if you would turn on everyone's mic for a minute, I might just ask, I just might do a little experiment here. Can you let me know when it's on?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay. So I'm going to count to three, and on the count of three, I would like everyone to just say hello. Everybody plays. You don't get to sit out. Just to get a sense of the fact that we're not all alone on the call. Okay, here I go. One, two, three. Hello.
Hello.
Okay, that's better.
Love, you are not alone.
It makes me feel comforted. Okay, you know, in a minute we might do a little bit more. We might get into some smaller groups so that we can spend a little time just introducing ourselves to one another. But just to begin and to review, today's tutorial topic is peace. And I know that at least some of you have taken a look at the second tutorial module in order to, whether you looked at the audio-video meditation or you listened to the interviews or you read the Global Manifesto that we have for this week. And that information is very helpful in terms of giving us all a ground, a very basic ground, having to do with learning a bit about the different cultural religious traditions that will be represented in Rome, get a hold of some of the issues that we'll be discussing. And that of course, is very helpful. I think that the larger purpose of these tutorials has to do with building our community even before we get to the conference in Rome. And also, I was thinking about this today, that it gives us a chance to practice a different way of thinking together, which has to do with the fact that the challenges that we're facing as individuals, locally and globally these days, are not solved through one single mode of thinking. We need more holistic, interdependent, interdisciplinary styles of thinking in order to get our mind around this kind of challenges, these kinds of challenges. So these calls should be an attempt to do to get us in the habit or practice thinking in that way together. So in service of that, we might roughly go over the domains and the stages one more time, because we'll be very familiar with this information by the time we get together. So Jim and I are going to do that for you briefly. Domain number one is reconciling with the other. Number two is transforming society. The third domain is embracing the earth family, and the fourth domain is rediscovering the sacred.
And then as we go through our conversations in Rome, as we try to wrap our heads around the idea that this cultural evolutionary shift, axial shift, is really taking place in the great religious and spiritual traditions, we'll talk through each of the four domains, and as we move through each domain, we'll take it through four different stages of the change revealing itself. The first, just signs of change, what's on the horizon. Systemic shift, how are our real structures beginning to change? Engagement, what are my opportunities really to begin to make a difference? And finally, embodiment, what do we see on the horizon? What's in store for us down the road as this change takes root?
So in the domain of reconciling with the other, which is one of our main focuses that involves the material for today, in the first stage, signs of change, the example that we're given to explore is the idea of interreligious awakening and the global interreligious movement.
And then when we talk about systemic shift, where we're really looking to see some structural changes that are coming into place, we'll talk about the passing of exclusivism. It's not gone from the scene, but the passing of exclusivism and the rise of a new openness.
And in the engagement stage, which is how do we get involved with these issues productively, responsibly, in this particular domain, we're looking at the idea of beyond dogma. How do we get in all of our religious traditions and spiritual orientations toward a more creative inquiry?
And finally, what do we see on the horizon? I love this embodiment one. It really is horizontal, not horizontal, but horizontal. The rise of the inter-religious story, when we take it as our own story and it's known and shared by all, spiritual evolution in our time, that is the great inter-religious story.
So I think for a brief moment here, what worked very well for us last time is, Donna, would you like to ask for a volunteer to give some brief words of centering? If anyone would like to just bring us into a moment of presence, you can indicate that you're willing to do that by pressing 1 on your telephone keypad, and I'll be able to see who's raising their hand. So
yes, this is just a moment for us to pull ourselves together and open ourselves up to the wisdom that we're going to be sharing and open our hearts and minds. And so we really would like a volunteer from one of our call-ins. And as Barbara said, just press 1 on your telephone keypad. That's like raising your hand in these conference calls, and we'll ask you to share. Thank you.
Thanks, Donna. Oh, good. I see that Reverend Dr. Peggy Price would be willing to help today. Hi, Peggy.
Hi, Barbara. Oh, so let's all take a good deep breath together. Because if there is any place where spirit resides, it's in the breath. And so as we breathe together, we become one. And we recognize that as we are joined together here on this call, it is as though we are sitting together in this place of timelessness and spacelessness, in the place of the divine name beyond all names, that place of awareness and love and peace and wholeness. And as we come together on this call, we come together with our hearts wide open and our minds ready to be heard as well as to understand, to share as well as to bless one another by this call. We give thanks for those who are presenting information for us today, and we give thanks for those who are sharing their questions, and most of all, we give thanks for the answers. And as we do that, we are blessing one another, and we know that as this time begins, it is already good and very good. And so we simply close by saying, and so it is. Amen.
Thank you, Peggy. The next thing that we had on our schedule today was we were going to give a short, not a lot of time, but a brief amount of time for all the participants on the call to start to get to know one another. And we can do that more effectively by breaking you out into smaller groups. Can we do three groups of three, Megan? Do our numbers work for that? We can add
20 people, so five groups of four.
Five groups of four. So we're just gonna break you out into five random groups of four, and we're gonna give you some cues about when you get into your groups. That the first thing that you might do is just speak out your first name, and we'll go. And then you can just share for just a minute or so in your small group. Beginning in alphabetical order, whoever has the name beginning with the first letter in the alphabet, and so on and so forth. That seems to be a good way to avoid too much confusion. So, Megan, why don't you break us out into groups, and then I'll tell everybody when we're getting ready to go. Just say
everyone is in groups now.
Yeah, everyone's in groups now. Can you put me in the groups? Okay, so am I in all the groups now?
Well, you're talking to everyone. Right?
Oh, I'm talking to everyone already. Okay, so as soon as we start a bell, then everyone can say their first names, and after that point, the first name starts talking. Just share a little bit about yourself and where you're from, maybe what organizations and initiatives you might be associated with, or why you're looking forward to the conference, why you're drawn to it. And then you'll get to know each other just a little bit, and we'll do that each week so that you can get to know your fellow participants. So how about a bell? Ready to go. Oh, okay, everyone. If the first person would wrap up in about the next 30 seconds and then the second person starts. Ask them to wrap. Okay, so if the person who's speaking now could wrap up in the next few seconds, and then the third person would start. Okay, so there should be one more person in each group, the fourth person to speak now, and then we'll be done with the small groups.
Please bring your conversation to a close. This breakout session is now ending.
Okay, I hope that at least gave you a little bit of a chance to get to know one another. You'll probably meet new people in the groups every time we have a call, so thanks for working that out with us. So let's move on then. We're gonna begin right now to talk about the tutorial having to do with the basic concepts in Islam and Zoroastrianism, so I'm going to ask Jim to walk us through that.
Since on the website we have these materials for each of the religions that we'll be talking about, I think I won't read the little blurb we have for Islam or the blurb for Zoroastrianism but I'll say a few words. And then under each of the religions, we have listed an excellence. What is it about that religion that really makes it stand out? This is inspired by, as I said last time, by the words of a great Swiss mystic and scholar, Fritjof Schuon, S-C-H-U-O-N, who wrote that every religion is superior to every other by virtue of something it does best. So what's the excellence of each of these traditions? What's the master story, as scholars call it, the great central tale of the religion? What's a very significant characteristic ritual pattern? And if we had to identify an ethical norm, what might it be? So we'll do that for each of these two traditions. Let me just say about Islam that it is the sister religion of Judaism and Christianity, which is sort of ironic given the fact that Muslims and Jews and Muslims and Christians are in this day and age often so estranged. But these religions are so close in so many ways that I often say that an observer from space, I guess that's because my dream job has always been to be the religion observer on board the Enterprise, working from the religion deck where we'd have scanners and so on. But you'd be hard-pressed if you were just doing a quick pass by a planet and observed by this planet and observed these three Western religions, you'd be hard-pressed to distinguish them as separate traditions. You might think they were different movements within the same. All three of these Western religions, and Islam is no exception, are profoundly concerned about social justice. Islam means surrender or submission, surrender to the will of Allah, which simply means the God, as this group would all be perfectly aware. From the Muslim point of view, Allah is not different from the God of the Jews or the God that is identified by the Christians or other gods identified by other traditions. And the key to Islam is making my will conform to the will of Allah. Islam is structured in a very interesting way with five pillars that sort of define what a good, obedient, submissive Muslim, and a Muslim is simply one who has submitted to the will of Allah. Islam means submission, Muslim as a past participle, one who has submitted. And there are five pillars that define that submission, five things that I need to do in my lifetime and need to guide my life. So I think that's the what I wanted to single out. The excellence of Islam, it seems to us, is the transformative power that is found in reconciling one's own personal will to the will of God or the will of the divine. Islam to believers means peaceful surrender to God and also the embrace of a very detailed vision of God's plan for just about every dimension of human life. So another part of the excellence of Islam is that it has a way of sacralizing or making holy every moment of life. The great story, one could identify several, but probably the master story of Islam is the pilgrimage of Abraham and his consort Hagar, the slave girl Hagar, to Mecca. Islam traces its lineage to Abraham not through Isaac, as Judaism does, but through the other son, Ishmael, son of Hagar. And a big part of that master story is Abraham and Ishmael rebuilding the structure of the Kaaba, this ancient structure in Mecca. the ritual pattern, again, we could identify several, but the one that really stands out is the Hajj, the pilgrimage that one, a devout Muslim, makes at least once in a lifetime. And I think it's fairly clear that the principal ethical norm of Islam is the striving for justice. So just a few things. We'll ask for comments in a moment. Zoroastrianism is, people don't realize how significant it is, how great its influence has been on the three Western religions, on Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Zoroastrianism talks about the fundamental juxtaposition of the good, which is the dominant, the good, but also the evil that is the resistance to the good. It's all often characterized as being this sort of battle between two gods, but that's not really accurate. There is the god Ahura Mazda, who is the supreme transcendent one, who is constantly striving to overcome the sort of latent evil in the universe. So Zoroastrianism really bequeaths to the younger religions, Judaism and Christianity and Islam, it bequeaths this notion of the good and evil contending in the universe, of heavens and hells, of angels and demons. That whole iconography really comes straight out of Zoroastrianism. It's a powerful, powerful influence. But it is the struggle against good and evil, and one of the great notions in Zoroastrianism is that you are called on, at an early point in your life, but then again and again, to pick your side, to choose the good or to slide into the evil. This is a monotheistic religion. Many Zoroastrians believe that Zoroaster, Zarathustra, was the first to preach monotheism. The excellence, and unfortunately we don't have this on the website. We just noticed today that it wasn't on the website, and I promise we'll make good on that. So here's my suggestion, that one of the excellences of Zoroastrianism is its profound insight into the sacredness of all of earthly creation. The elements, earth, air, fire, and water, are all sacred, and so are the minerals and the plants. And Zoroastrians would add to that mix human energy. But the idea that this earthly world that we inhabit is sacred, so that one of the interesting things about Zoroastrianism is that the dead cannot be burned, that would defile the fire. They can't be thrown into the water, that would defile the water. They can't be buried, and so on. And so the dead are left traditionally in towers of silence, where their bones are cleaned by the birds, vultures, usually. There's an absolutely parallel tradition in Tibet. So anyway, the sacredness of the elements, I think, is quite beautiful. The master story of Zoroastrianism, if I had to pick one, it is what Zoroaster preached and what is contained in the Gathas, the scripture of Zoroastrianism, that the one God is transcendent, doesn't dwell in this world, it doesn't inhabit this world, but is transcendent and is represented in relationship with human beings and relationship with the world by his attributes. Ultimately, the tradition settled on seven attributes of God, which are often referred to as the rich or the bounteous immortals. And each one of these is an attribute of God, as well as a human virtue. So there's a really delightful interplay there. God's attributes shape the possibilities of the world, and they also lay the foundation for the most important human virtues. So that's the beautiful master story. The ritual pattern, if I can just go on, of Zoroastrianism is also really beautiful. You can't talk about Zoroastrianism without talking about the sacred fire. Lots of people believe, and critics of the tradition have often accused Zoroastrians of being fire worshippers. It's not true at all. For them, fire, however, is an icon. It's a symbol. It represents the divine. And so the great rituals of Zoroastrianism, prayers and symbolic rituals, are often carried out before the sacred fire. It's quite a beautiful thing. And it's easy to identify the ethical norm of Zoroastrianism. I can't imagine many Zoroastrians would disagree because they repeat this phrase over and over again. The ethical norm is good thoughts, good words, good deeds. So anybody want to hop in there? Any of our core group members? Harold, do you want to add to that? Anyone? Gordon?
Want to devote my time to Islam, Jim?
Oh, yes, to either one, please.
I will do that later.
Okay, fine.
Okay, how about some of our other participants in terms of questions or comments as you did review the material, as you had thoughts about this? The only one that I want to speak off the top of my head is that the more that I learn and hear repeated again and again what are some of the norms and the stories and excellences of the traditions, the more I keep saying, well, that sounds like my belief system, you know, as opposed to something that sounds very, very other, which I think probably is an insight that many of us are sharing. As we learn more, we begin to see our common roots rather than our differences. And I wondered if there's anyone on the call that would like to comment on something like that. John.
That's the great part about interreligious experience.
Absolutely. John Wozik?
Yes. Jim, what's the relationship between Zoroastrianism and Baha'i, other than the fact they're both in Persia, or were?
So they're both in Persia, but Baha'i traditionally has a closer relationship to Islam, and that's the background from which in which the revelation to Baha'u'llah came. But I think there are lots of not similarities, but sort of shared vibrations, because you also find in Baha'i that very strong sense of the sacredness of all earthly life and the sacredness of the elements and so on. It's not accidental that Zoroastrians tend to be very, very environmentally conscious, and this is shared by all the Baha'is that I've ever known. So maybe that is a natural sort of affinity. And hello, John. Good to hear your voice.
Thank you, Jim.
That's interesting. Abigail, do you have a question?
I just wanted to piggyback your comment, Barbara, because that's exactly how I've been feeling over these past few years, just being with different interfaith people. I think the very first time I was at a lecture when different people spoke, I kept saying to my husband, I must be a Baha'i. I believe that. I must be a Buddhist. I believe that. I must, you know, and I think that once, you know, the core values and the core principles are known, we really do realize that we have so much more in common. And, you know, all that, the barriers start to fall down. And that's what I just love when I start learning and about all these faiths. I just wanted to make that comment.
Thank you, Abigail. We'll take one more. Chris Hibbert. Hi, Chris. We haven't heard from you. I haven't heard your voice yet.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for being here.
I was just thinking about the what everyone's been saying, and I know that my experience in different countries working with different religions, and particularly what comes to mind is my work in Syria. I traveled for 3 weeks on a peace mission with a group of Sufis, and that the mystical aspects of each religion that was so valuable to me to know and learn the different mystics of each tradition, and in the work that we did in the mosques and with the great mufti of Syria and with the people on the streets and the Mennonites and the Father Paolo, who runs a Catholic mission, a 1,000-year-old mission in the hillsides of Syria, that allowed me to be with the other, to be on their ground, be working with them, that those notions of Sufism were just so beautiful in terms of what we needed to know in terms of rituals with the Islamic beliefs, and when we were in the mosques, as I say, and in these people's homes and so forth. So I just thought I would add that it added so much more to the appreciation and the beauty of just my relationship with God, with higher intelligence.
Thank you, Chris. That's beautiful. And then one more brief comment and we'll move on, and is from Judy Colley.
Hi, Barbara. It's good to hear your voice.
Hi, Judy.
I just wanted that maybe ditto to what people have been saying about the common expression that we seem to hear in each of the renderings of the excellence, which raises a little curiosity in me. As Jim says, the excellence of each religion seems to be an aspect of how they are superior. And yet, as I listen, it sounds like one excellence just being spoken in different dialects. So that's my reflection on all that I'm picking up from these expressions of excellence.
That's lovely. Thank you. Different dialects. Wonderful. Since the clock is ticking away here, because this is all such interesting material, if it's all right with all of you, I think that we should move on to a little discussion about the audio interviews. You listened, many of you, to an interview with Jamal Rahman and also with Dr. Naheed Anga. And so, Jim, maybe do you want to kick us off on the discussion on the interview with Jamal and invite Harold to share some comments as well?
Yeah, I'll just acquaint people who might not be aware of Jamal and Naheed, if I can just say a word or two about who they are, and then maybe invite Harold to say something more about the Jamal conversation, and then we can take up the conversation with Naheed. Jamal Rahman is a Sufi. He's originally from Bangladesh, lives in this country in the Seattle area, and he's part of a really intriguing group of a sort of traveling interfaith roadshow. They call themselves the Three Interfaith Amigos. One's a rabbi, one's a Protestant minister, and the third is Jamal, a Muslim imam. He does work in the interfaith community. He presides over an interfaith congregation, but these three do a lot of traveling around the country, and they have really promoted interreligious understanding in an extraordinary way. Jamal Rahman is one of the most genuine and engaging people you'll ever meet. He's just a delight, and I was just thinking of some of the comments. When you meet Jamal, it's as though when he speaks, you feel that he's speaking for you. Oh, well, yeah, I've always believed that, too. That's me talking there. So a delightful, delightful person, and the interview with him was just, I think it was really sweet. It was wonderful. If you haven't yet listened to it, I really urge you to. And Naheed Anga is also just an extraordinary person. She's a pioneer in the interfaith movement. She is lives in what city in California? Do you remember, Barbara?
She doesn't live in California, isn't she? In the UK?
No. No, she was in the UK visiting her daughter when she was doing the interview. She's in California. But in any case, she's the head of the International Association of Sufism, which has been a major player in the interfaith movement. She's also a real leader in the Muslim women's movement worldwide. And, you know, a lot of people sort of despair of real evolutionary change. People who don't know much about Islam think that it's not going to happen there. And a few moments with Naheed, and we talked about this in the interview, it's one of the high points, about what's happening with women in Islam worldwide, and not just in Islam, but in Islam. And it was very inspiring and very hopeful. And I loved the comment about the experience in Syria and meeting Sufis and experiencing the mystical tradition. When we've been saying, you know, we encounter these traditions and we feel as though somehow they are our own or they are kindred spirits, that experience becomes even more powerful when one encounters the mystical teachings of various traditions. So it was really excellent, these two conversations, each with a practicing Sufi, a practicing Muslim mystic. And maybe that's a good jumping off point. So let me If it's all right, let me turn to Harold, and who's also, who knows Jamal, who, to see if he's got some comments about that.
As I said before, I had the great pleasure of meeting Jamal Rahman, and I think he's a person, I mean, it seems like the sun shines from his face. And I had the opportunity to learn some Sufi dances with him, together with Brother Wayne Teasdale.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to the first point I'd like to point out from Jamal is, toward the end of his talk, he said, God has deliberately created diversity. And he can support this statement from a very famous verse from the Quran, probably most of you know. If God had so willed, he would have made all of you one community, but he has not done so, so that he may test you in what he has given to you. So compete with one another in good works. To God you shall return, and he will tell you the truth about that which you have been disputing. Now, I read this, the statement from the Quran and from Jamal, as telling us that God is the creator of difference, that difference are part of God's plan, that the chief rabbi of Britain, Rabbi Sacks, always stresses that the reason for this is that God wants to teach humanity the dignity of difference. And my own teacher, Rabbi Abram Joshua Heschel, made the same point. He repeated it many times when he first said it in his essay, No Religion is an Island, where he stressed that, quote, in this eon, diversity of religions is the will of God, and that holiness is not the monopoly of any particular religion or tradition. And he also said that no word is God's last word. And I was just thinking about this last statement, and I remember that I've read Sufis who said the same thing. I don't have time to talk about them right now, but perhaps at a later point. The other point that I wanted to, the reason I'm stressing this point is because I believe that our vision of the other will determine how we act towards the other. Jamal is very serious about dialogue, not just with Jews and Christians, the Abrahamic faiths, but he's also open to Asian religions. And I just wanted to mention his citations from Gandhi, who was really one of the great pluralists who wanted to free us of arrogance, prejudice, ignorance, violence. The statements that Jamal made was, a friendly study of the world's religions is a sacred duty, statement from Gandhi, and also every religion has truth and untruth. So these, I think Gandhi said, we have the truth, but not the complete truth, for God reveals his truth through instruments that are imperfect. I just wanted to add that. He also said, all religions are true, all religions have some error in them. And my only question for Jamal, I hope I have an opportunity to discuss with him, is he said that Gandhi, at least I understood him to say, that Gandhi is not saying that the verses are not divine. It's in our interpretation that's problematic. But I think that Gandhi was open to the possibility that some of the verses in our sacred text, some of the particularly the violent passages in our sacred text, actually have a human element. But this is an issue that every tradition has to work out for itself, how it's going to deal. If it believes that every single word is divine, it's different than believing that there may be a human element in the tradition. So I think that's a very interesting issue. And I just want to end with a quote from Gandhi that I see as supporting Jim Kenney's book. Gandhi said,
I'm not going to cut you off then.
I'm not going to cut you off. I can see clearly the time coming when people belonging to different faiths will have the same regard for other faiths that they have for their own.
Oh, that's a powerful statement. Yes. How I was thinking that we...
I'll stop
sorry,
here.
I was thinking that we might ask here for just a few, if there are any comments from the rest of us on the call with regard to what Harold has just shared, and thank you, Harold, very much. There's so much more to discuss about this, and I think we'll be doing that with you on future calls because there's just not enough time, but it's very, very insightful and so much material. Any comments from anyone else on the call that at this point? Okay, so let's move forward a little. I'm going to make a suggestion, Jim, if you don't mind, that since Gordon and Joan may need to be leaving the call, we're running a little low on time, that we maybe exchange at this point and talk about the Global Manifesto, the Sevilla Statement on Violence, and come back to the Nahid interview if we have some time.
Sure.
Would that be okay? Okay, so maybe you just want to introduce the section.
Let me just introduce that. Mm-hmm. I'll just lay it out. We're talking about different charters, different documents throughout the 20th century that sort of lay the groundwork for our own charter, and we will, along the way, we'll touch on the global ethic from the 93 Parliament of the World's Religions, a call to our guiding institutions, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But one of the really extraordinary statements and that was originally brought to my attention by the late Brother Wayne Teasdale, whom we've already mentioned, known to so many of us, and this was a particular favorite of his, and he was close to a lot of the people that were involved in the drafting. And for a 1986 statement, this is really extraordinary. It took a scientific approach to the idea of violence and simply said, if you've had a chance to look at it, it's scientifically incorrect to say we've inherited a tendency to make war from our animal ancestors, to say that human beings have a violent brain, to say that war is caused by instinct or any single motivation, to say that the course of human evolution, in the course, there's been a selection for aggressive behavior more than for other kinds of behavior. And this was really groundbreaking in 1986. I would simply say that, and I'm sure Gordon will and Joan can add much more to this, that the scientific consensus has really shifted, and the whole absurd notion of the killer ape is behind us. And I would just recommend to those of you who are concerned about violence and who imagine that we have just been through the most violent century in human history, to take a look at a remarkable new book called The Better Angels of Our Nature by the evolutionary psychologist Steven Pinker. The subtitle of the book is Why Violence Has Declined, and he begins with a very counterintuitive announcement that the 20th century may in fact be the least violent in human prehistory and history, and then he makes his case. And he would agree with all of this, that violence is in no way locked into our brains or our behavior. So that was the ground that was broken in Seville, in 1986. Quite remarkable for its time.
Thanks. And I had a great, interesting conversation with Gordon the other day, and Gordon was discussing some schools of thought, philosophy and educational voices, neurobiological voices, different ways of thinking about this question of violence and the human perspective. And Gordon had a few comments to make about that, and I wondered if you'll share those with us now.
Thanks, Barbara. And Jim, I'm really eager to meet you. Hearing you speak of Brother Wayne, who Joan and I loved very dearly, and I think he would be very much appreciative of our conversation and what's happening here. So, Barbara, we talked about this Sevilla statement and why it was important. And to me, the thing that really stood out most was the question, are we free or not? Are we determined to operate violently in the world? Or actually, are we free human beings? And that's kind of at the root. That's kind of a root question here. And it has to do with an image, our image of what it means to be human. If we are inherently violent, it's rather a hopeless game. But I think it's instructive to see where that view of human beings has been around for a long time. It's, you know, very famously a kind of Hobbesian view of human beings. And Sigmund Freud, after World War I broke out, descended into a really deep pessimism, as did much of the world. In fact, while there was hope and progress leading up to World War I, science, rationality, optimism, democracy, and then all of a sudden there was this unholy marriage of technology and terror on these killing fields of World War I. And the world sunk into a level where all we saw was dystopian thought about the future and about the nature of human beings. Freud wrote a book in 1930 called Civilization and Its Discontent. And in it he said, man is, quote, a savage beast to whom consideration to his own kind is something alien, unquote. And then as far as the golden rule that one should, quote, love one's neighbor as oneself, Freud wrote that, quote, nothing else runs so counter to the original nature of man, unquote. So this was really kind of a hopeless state. And then I think it was very interesting and brave and important that these scientists from various domains and around the world got together in Sevilla drafted the Sevilla Statement on Violence, which basically objected to that view of man as inherently violent, as in fact a great error and a great disservice to the human spirit and who we really are. In our conversation, and I don't want to take too much time, Barbara, but I was reviewing a book that I think is really very important by Jeremy Rifkin, and it's called The Empathic Civilization, The Race to Global Consciousness in a World of Crisis. And it is a whole review of how the empathic nature of human beings has grown over time, over the millennia, and that it has grown in a climate where human beings were more and more brought into connection with people who were different from themselves and therefore had to understand outside the framework that they had perhaps grown up in or been enculturated in. And it brings up to date, even more up to date even than this 1986 Sevilla Statement, where science stands on this. And so I'm just going to mention four areas where science has really shifted our view of what it means to be human. One is a stream of psychology called object relations theory. And in it, they basically take issue, the object relations theorists take issue with Freud, who thought that our libidinal drives were simply to satisfy our impulses. And they said, no, sociability is the primary drive of human beings, the need for human connection, love, affection, and companionship. One of the object relation theorists, Heinz Kohut, and he's one among several, many actually, Winnicott, Fairborn, says that actually relationship precedes the emergence of an individual and actually creates the individual, and that the individual is created in reciprocity. Reciprocity is the heart of sociality. If reciprocity is blocked, the development of selfhood is stunted and psychopathology follows. That empathy really develops in the relationship, especially with the mother and the child, and that we need that empathic relationship to actually grow. I have a just quick summary of some of that object relations theory, and it's here. Object relation theorists put a new mirror to human nature, and what they saw reflected, a view of our species as an affectionate, highly social animal who craves companionship, abhors isolation, and is biologically predisposed to express empathy to other human beings. That you get, you know, that you get an empathic child by being empathic with the child. So what we see out of this is that violence is actually an aberration, and it comes from something that stunts, blocks, or prevents that empathic reciprocity, that kind of relationship. And that, the importance of that is it tells us that there's actually realm for action here in the way we educate, in the way we support, in the way we create frameworks for reciprocity, that there's room here to change our future. And then,
Gordon?
Yes.
This is going to be part of an ongoing discussion because we're winding up to the top of the hour.
Okay.
So I'd love to hear more because I had this discussion with you on the phone the other day and it was fascinating. So can we continue it and still respect our time limit to people to be off the phone in approximately an hour?
Okay. Should we just call it?
Why don't
right?
you could you just name the other realms without going into the description, and then we'll pick it up at a later date.
The other realms are neuroscience that we've been able to learn from brain scanning about this amazing thing, the mirror neurons in human beings in the prefrontal cortex. That means that we're actually wired for empathy. That's actually our nature and what makes us social beings. So neuroscience has advanced considerably. Evolutionary biology has really shown that, in fact, we proceed through cooperation, not simply competition. And epigenetics has basically shown that we're not determined by our genes, but that, in fact, the environment is a critical factor and that it affects our epigenetic composition and therefore how our genes actually manifest, whether they're on or off. So I mean, those are just four broad areas of science that support a different view of human beings.
No, I think it's fascinating, and it also demonstrates the complexity of the conversation and why we're so determined to get a jump start on this conversation before we get to the conference, because we have some definite objective goals that we hope to achieve there. But the conversation is so multi-stranded, and there's so many deep conversations that would come out of some of these topics. So, Jim, I'll check in with you now, and I think that we're going to need to leave the Naheed interview for people to review on their own, you think?
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And do you want to say
I'd say one thing. I'd say pay particular attention if you listen to her interview. She talks about women in Islam, but there's a wonderful conversation about the role of poetry in giving expression to mystical experience. It's quite beautiful.
Absolutely. Don't miss that. That's an excellent interview. They all are. Did you want to say anything briefly about the charter at this point?
Yeah, I would simply say that actually we've sort of covered that. What we would, had we had a little more time, we would have talked about how the first domain is shaping the charter. And I think we'll touch on that at a later time. But the first domain are changing relationship to the other. And everything we've just been talking about, and especially everything that Gordon talked about, really is going to be reflected in the charter and reflected in our conversations about that first domain, our changing relationship to the other.
Fantastic. I'm just going to ask if there's anybody on the call who just has any closing comments or questions before I just tell you what's going to be on the next call and what the date is. Any comments from anyone on the call? I appreciate you all being here. It's really a lively kind of discussion. Okay. So we're just a couple minutes over time, but thank you for being here. Our next call on Module 3 will be on July 12th. The general issue there, it has to do with restorative justice. The spiritual tradition that we'll be looking at on that call is Judaism. And the audio interviews and extra readings are with Rabbi Deborah Bronstein and Dr. Sally King, two separate interviews. And the two global manifestos that we've summarized on the website are the Brandt Report and the document that Jim was referring to earlier, An Initial Declaration Toward a Global Ethic. So that is the kind of work you can delve into as deeply as you want to. There's
plenty to read and listen to. And I thank you all for being here, and hope that you're enjoying the tutorial, and we'll see you hopefully again on, hear you hopefully again on July 12th. Okay, have a great couple of weeks, everybody. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Barbara. Bye-bye, everybody.